This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
We're actually, you know, we're feeling really privileged to have Don here with us this evening. You know, he's one of the most accomplished writers today of crime and mystery novels, a number of which, of course, have been or are being made into movies. The son of a sailor and a librarian, Don grew up with a love of books and storytelling in a small coastal Rhode Island town. He left at age 17 to study journalism at the University of Nebraska, where he earned a degree in African studies. While in college, he traveled to Southern Africa, sparking a lifelong involvement with that continent. Don's travels also took him to California, to Idaho, to Montana, before he ended up in New York City, where he eventually became a writer, making his living initially as a movie theater manager and then as a private investigator. He left to get a master's degree in military history and intended to go into the Foreign Service, but instead joined a friend's photographic safari firm in Kenya. You can see where he gets a lot of his material. And in Kenya, he led trips there as well as hiking expeditions in southwestern China, and later directed Shakespeare productions during summers in Oxford, England. So, sounds kind of dizzying, doesn't it? Yeah. While bouncing back and forth between Asia, Africa, Europe, and America, Don wrote his first novel, A Cool Breeze on the Underground, which was nominated for an Edgar Award. By then, with a wife and young son, he went back to investigative work, mostly in California, where he and his family lived in hotels for almost 3 years as he worked cases and became a trial consultant. Is that the son who is here? That's the one. I don't know if you remember the hotel days. Where is his son? There he is, way in the back. Right, he's now a D.C. resident. Aren't you glad you decided to come today, right? And then when he got a film and a publishing deal for his novel, The Death and Life of Bobby Z, that finally allowed Don to be a full-time writer and to settle in California, which has been the setting, as many of you who've read his novels know, it's the setting for many of his books. Branching into television and film, Don, with his friend Shane Salerno, wrote a television series, UC Undercover, and the two also collaborated on the screenplay of his novel, Savages. Other novels have attracted the attention of filmmakers and actors such as Oliver Stone, Michael Mann, Martin Scorsese, Ridley Scott, Robert De Niro, and Leonardo DiCaprio, and for good reason, because Don's plots tend to be gripping and rooted in lots of realistic detail, and he has a knack for cultural and historical context and larger themes. His new book, a crime thriller entitled The Force, is set in New York City and opens with Sergeant Denny Malone, the head of a special task force charged with battling drugs, guns, and gangs, who is himself in federal lockup. It seems he and his partners made off with millions in drugs and cash after a recent bust, and federal investigators are looking into the case. But for Malone to betray his fellow cops would bring down the force at a time it's confronting a racial crisis that threatens to engulf them. And the plot after that thickens. Review in Kirkus said this of the book, quote, "By turns grim and giddy, this is a good read in the service of dark cops." And USA Today called the book simply intoxicating. So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Don Winslow.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks. Can you all hear me okay? Thank you. Thank you all for coming out. Gosh, I'm flattered. I also got the big comfy chair for the first time ever, so that's great. And thanks for being here. I'm just going to talk a little bit I know I'm supposed to talk about the book. I may or may not, because it's a Saturday afternoon, and I've been talking about the book a lot. Might want to talk about something else. You know, you're all laughing when he was giving my biography. You know, what could I tell you? I needed to make a living, you know, somehow. Nobody stamps your papers to become a writer. Do you know what I mean? If you go to college and you go to medical school, boom, they stamp your paper, you're a doctor. If you go and you go to law school, they stamp your paper and you're a lawyer. There's no stamp for writer, you know. I went to college and majored in African history, which they stamp hardcore unemployable. You know, what do you do with a degree in African history? There are like five teaching positions in America that were all taken. And so I went off to chase leopards around, you know, with Nikon cameras, which is one of the best jobs you could ever have. I also manage movie theaters in New York City, as it was alluded to. I almost lost the job on the first night that I had it. I showed up for work, and the manager, my putative boss, said words to the effect of, you know, if I'm around, you won't know what questions to ask. And he went to the bar three blocks down. About 5 minutes later, someone in the balcony started yodeling, ululating. And a very large young usher who was already hated me because he wanted the job I got, came down and he said, there's a guy yodeling in the balcony. What do you want me to do? I said, throw him out. Not realizing that this particular usher was somewhat literal-minded. A few minutes later, I'm standing in the concession lounge, which had a glass picture window so you could buy, you know, overpriced cookies and stuff and still watch the movie, which ironically was Mel Brooks's High Anxiety. And all of a sudden, the yodeling stopped. The theater got very quiet, which is unusual for a Mel Brooks film. And I saw a body come right past the glass front window. Boom! And land. And the usher came down smiling at me and said, I did what you told me to. I threw him out. He had grabbed the guy, bench pressed him over the edge of the balcony and onto the floor. And I thought, well, this is great. I've had the job for 17 minutes and I'm going to get fired. I didn't know what to do. This is just between us here now, right? This was a long time ago. The statute of limitations have expired. We dragged him into the alley and I woke him up. Dear friends here, and I said, you're lucky. I would have had him killed you if I ever see you again. And the guy got up and ran away, and I kept my job. That is my introduction into The Force. The Force is a book about the NYPD, about a special task force, as Brad alluded to. And, you know, I was just deeply influenced as a kid by those 70s and 80s movies like The French Connection, Serpico, Prince of the City. In fact, the guy that Prince of the City was based on, Bobby Lucy, was a friend of mine. And I always wanted to write a book in that vein, you know. But never did. I guess I am known as a California writer. I've heard that a lot. And a lot of my books are set in California or just across the border in Mexico. But I was born in New York, born on Staten Island, just where the you know, principal of this story is born. Lived and worked in New York. After I was a movie theater manager, I got a job as a private detective because apparently I was ruthless and violent enough to get that job. And so New York's always been, you know, a real part of my life. I wanted to return there as a writer, but I think I finally felt that this was the right time, that I had the right set of skills and chops to write this book, but that also it was a time when writing a book about policing in a major city felt relevant. It felt meaningful, and it felt like I could write a, I hope, good, tight you know, interesting, exciting crime book at the same time to talk about some issues in our country today. And so that's what I tried to do in The Force, and that's what I hoped that I did in The Force. And we'll see, you know, that's up to you all. So we're here today. I thank you for coming out. I would much rather spend more of our time answering your questions and having a conversation than I would just yapping at you like this. So if it's all right with you, Brad, why don't we throw it open? And I hope there's some questions. And believe me, you hope there's some questions, because if they're not, I'll just keep talking and telling stories.
The microphone's back here.
It's right there, right in front of you.
Hi, can I ask you a few questions about books, whether you've read them or haven't read them? Not to judge you as being more better than that guy or less than that guy, but they're examples of, like, Eugene Izzy.
No.
Okay. Marcel Mendesino.
No.
Gerald Petievich.
No.
Okay. But, fine.
Did I fail? This feels like high school to me.
You have created a flowing fiction that's really quick. I don't think anyone writes quicker than you do. And that's, to me, what makes it great.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
You redeemed both of us in the last 12 seconds. Yeah. What the gentleman has basically, in effect, said is I'm an ignorant, you know, guy and ill-read, and that's probably the truth, but I do try to write well.
But you never wrote because Hemingway hurt you.
What?
You never wrote a book because Hemingway hurt you.
Hemingway hurt me?
H-U-R-T, yeah.
Huh, okay. You know, when I was like 13 and 14, I thought Hemingway was it. When I got about 30, I thought kind of less so. I kind of like the short stories of Hemingway's hold up for me. This is a terrible thing to say in a bookstore, and how arrogant of me. The novels don't.
Novels don't hold up.
For me.
What does?
Oh, Jim Harrison holds up for me. Richard Russo holds up for me. Tolstoy holds up for me. George Eliot holds up for me. A lot of folks hold up for me. Fitzgerald holds up for me.
Yes.
Dos Passos holds up for me.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of guys. Yes, sir. And I think we're asking people to step to the microphone because they're recording this for legal purposes.
So a lot of your books have been or will be made into movies.
Yeah.
What's the next one that's coming up? Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. I
hope
forgot
you do.
For a second. The Force, this one.
Okay.
Well, it's kind of a race right now. We'll see. They're working on a book I did called The Cartel. About
great.
Mexican drug cartels, go figure. And this book, yeah, that's that book, The Force, James Mangold is directing it. And I just found out earlier in the week, drum roll, wait for it, David Mamet's writing the screenplay. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So here's my question is, how do you separate out, as the author of this of these brilliant books, The Cartel and Power of the Dog, and you're the writer, and then it gets handed over. Where do you step back and say, "Now that's it, it's something else," or how involved are you in it, and what's that like for you?
You know, earlier in my career, I took the sort of classic novelist's approach of take the check and go home, you know, put it in the bank and forget about it. I did not realize how badly it would hurt. Hurt to see a really bad movie made out of your book. Now, no one sets out to make a bad movie, but it happens. And it happened to a book of mine called The Death and Life of Bobby Z, which became a movie called Bobby Z because apparently Death and Life was too complicated to include. And I sat in that theater in front of a test audience. You know, as they're all hating the movie too. And it was a 3.5-hour drive home during which I decided I was going to change my relationship with Hollywood. So now I'm involved. Now, some days they like that, and a lot of days they don't like that. But I insist on being part of the conversation, you know. And what I try to communicate to film people with varying degrees of success, I say, guys, 2,000 years before you were editing, we were editing. I know about cuts. I do it all the time, you know. But what I want to hear is the whys and wherefores of cuts and what you're replacing it with. I fully understand. You know, Cartel is a 600-and-something page book. You can't make that whole book into a movie. No one would watch it, myself included, okay? But we want to make intelligent choices and choices for a reason. So I do stay involved. And it does not make me the most popular man, you know, in West L.A. Yes, sir.
Just a three-part question, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
First question is cartel related. I know you write a lot about the cartels and everything going to Mexico. You're, you know, a subject matter expert, probably. Do you think El Chapo will go to trial in America? Did the Flores brothers turn him in? And who's going to play Art Keller?
The last one's easy. I don't know. There have been talks with Mr. DiCaprio, and there have been talks with other folks, but I don't have a definitive answer for you. On the other two questions, do you think El Chapo will go to trial publicly? If I had to bet, sir, I'd bet against it, because I don't think anybody wants him testifying publicly. Because, look, what does he have to trade anymore? He can't trade down for another drug kingpin, because he's the top. Okay, so that avenue's closed to him. But what he can trade for are names in the Mexican government, and by extension, names in American government, because I think it's pretty clear that the Mexican government, and by the way, for reasons that I can't really argue with, probably cooperated with Guzman and the Sinaloa cartel in an attempt to achieve some sort of peace and order in Mexico. Do I think the Flores brothers turned him in? They sure tried. Okay, but we need to remember that that's a two-way street. Guzman, I resist calling him Chapo, by the way, because it makes him sound like a cute little character out of the Seven Dwarfs, and he's a mass murderer. Okay, that not enough bad things can happen to, in my opinion, to make me happy. All right, but Guzman was a rat from at least as early as 2001. Guzman was actively cooperating with DEA as a way of getting his rivals out of the business. Now, and also subordinates that were causing too much trouble. Okay? With the Flores brothers in Chicago, it wasn't Guzman that flipped on them. It was one of his partner's sons. Ismael Zambada's kid got popped, taking a bunch of cocaine over the Arizona border. And he flipped on the Flores brothers, and then he has now disappeared from federal custody. There was a trial date in San Diego. He never made. Highly technical information. I'll move it along. No, they did not turn him in. His partners turned him in because he was causing too much trouble in Sinaloa and messing things up. You're welcome, sir. Yes, sir.
Hi. Two quick questions, if I may. All right. So first of all, you sort of have cross the line from fiction to nonfiction in your travel through the cartels.
Yeah, a little bit.
And the Esquire article was brilliant.
Thank you.
Do you ever worry about shining a light on a subject like that for your own personal safety?
No. Look, I don't want to, you know, in any way compare myself to journalists in Mexico. Mm-hmm. The cartel is dedicated to 138 journalists in Mexico who were killed telling that story, and since that book came out, 39 more have been killed, one just 2 weeks ago, you know, sort of the dean of Mexican mm-hmm. journalism in many ways. No, I live in relative safety on this side of the border, and I am a fiction writer, mm-hmm. and cartel leaders are not great readers.
Fair enough.
You know, Guzman has a fifth grade education, you know. Sends out tweets, but I'm not saying nothing. About that. every once in a while, in all candor, I do get a threat. Mm-hmm. I don't take them terribly seriously, but I am a little more aware of my surroundings. I'm very aware where Brad is at every moment.
I, Understandable.
Okay.
Backing all the way up to California Fire and Life.
Good Lord, man.
Great book.
Thank you.
And I always wondered, there was so much inside knowledge of that business, the fire casualty investigation business, and also the jury testing aspects of that book. Did you have personal experience in either of those areas?
That's what I did.
Is that what you did?
When Brad alluded to us living for 3 years in hotels in California, most of my work was on arson cases for insurance companies, because everything that people bought on balloon payments during the Reagan administration, they burned down when those payments came due during the first Bush administration. So, everything, it was just... It was bonfires out there. So I did a lot of arson investigation. And in fact, there's a couple of cases in that book that, are pretty close to the bone. And then I was also the person who would then help witnesses prepare to testify about that stuff.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi. First, I want to just say thank you for another solid installment. I'm very compelled by the force. I read it a couple months ago as a galley.
Thank you, sir.
Somebody works here at Politics and Prose, definitely, formerly, but I definitely came back to hear your talk.
And, thank you.
I just have a question about the characters. The characters in the force are, very broad, very dynamic, and your dialogue is so on point. But specifically, the main character, Malone, and so you have this character who can be described as the anti-hero for better or less, and he talks about how he crosses the line of his virtues and convictions one step at a time. So would it be reductive? I guess the question is more specifically, what is producing this anti-hero? Is corruption in the police force pretty much as endemic as like the hustlers that run the streets? Are they just products of the system or not? What's your take?
To research this book, I spent an awful lot of time with cops, including being out on the streets with them, interviewing them. But I've had these conversations for decades with these guys. I don't, and not to be offensive, I don't buy into the hero or anti-hero definition. Mm-hmm. As a reader, I do, but as a writer, I can't. Mm-hmm. All right? My job is, the way I define it, is to help bring the reader into worlds they otherwise couldn't get into, or help them see it in a different way. And in order to do that, I need to get into my characters' heads and see the world from their points of view. Okay, so in that sense, when I'm sitting there typing, I ain't thinking about good or bad or moral or immoral or hero or anti-hero. Yeah. I am trying to take a realistic, plausible character from that world as I've learned about it and try to let you all in. Okay, yeah. Now, is corruption endemic in police departments? Of course. Of course, about every 20 years, NYPD has a major corruption scandal, like clockwork. And then everyone pays a lot of attention to corruption, and it stops for a while. It's like anything else, all right? But we're talking about two kinds of corruption. There's financial corruption, for lack of a better phrase. Cops take money or take dope. That goes on, and you'll read about that and see it. New York's by no means unique in that regard. But there's also a much more insidious, seductive kind of corruption, and that's the cutting corners corruption. A cop knows that a guy in that apartment over there is going to hurt somebody, right? Mm-hmm. But can't get a warrant to get in that apartment. So he figures out a different way to do it. That's illegal. Makes that arrest, goes to court. Now what does he have to do? Lie about it. So now we have two technical crimes going on. And this happens, and this goes on, and guys told me this, all right? So I can't say, is that right, is that wrong? Yeah, it's wrong, but if, I had cops, and I won't go on and on, and I know there are other questions, but I had cops tell me with tears coming down their faces 20 years after an event, going into an apartment on a domestic disturbance, knowing they're going to be back there again for the homicide investigation, and not being able to do anything about it, and regretting they didn't break those laws, you know? So I don't want to roll anything, you know what I mean, with the roller. Good cops, bad cops, good lawyers, bad lawyers, good bookstore owners, bad bookstore owners. It all comes in the specifics. Did I come close to answering the question you asked?
Sure enough did. Thank you so
all
much.
All right. Thank you, sir. Hello.
Hey. So, first of all, thank you so much for this book. I think I said on Twitter that I'm reading it very slowly because I keep pausing to kind of marvel at how good it is.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very much. I'm embarrassed. Yeah.
I have that effect on people. But my question is, I remember reading that while they were writing Schindler's List, they found themselves having to tone down a lot of the things that Ray Fiennes' character's historical counterpart did because they were too cartoonishly evil that no one would believe them.
Yep.
With all the research that you write about for a lot of the extremely bad people that you write about, do you ever find yourself having to do similar things?
Yes. People don't believe this because Cartel is an extraordinarily violent book. All of it true. There were other incidents that were true that I did not include in the book for exactly that reason. They were so evil, so over the top, so horrible, I didn't have the heart to do it. That simple. You know, and sometimes I, in all candor, look back on that book. When I was on tour with it 2 years ago, you know, when they made me read parts of it, you know. Thank you so much, by the way, for not doing that. Y'all should thank him, too. I had some regrets about some of the things I did include, you know, even though that they came from real incidents, you know. So, yes, I have backed off on some of those things.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
In the Cartel and the Power of the Dog, you capture some of the harms that come to Mexican society as a result of demand on this side of the border.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're writing the third installment in that trilogy, the degree to which opiates and illicit drugs are in the public's attention is fairly unprecedented, and the harms are by no means balanced between both societies, but we're more aware of the cost here than previously, if not any more, any closer to understanding it or reacting in any helpful kind of way.
Right.
Can you talk about, you probably can't talk about whether and how that's a thread in your upcoming book, but can you talk about how you think about the opioid crisis and what you'd like people to know that isn't in the prevailing narrative?
Sure. The opioid crisis, gosh, it's just too close to home. You know, we're 2016, 62,000 Americans died of opioid overdoses, more than in car accidents. So 62,000, I did do the math one day because I was writing an op-ed piece about it. I don't remember the math, but you can do it. Divide it by 365, divide that by 24. So basically, while we're having this session today, several people will die of opioid overdoses. Okay. The opioid crisis came about in its present form, partially as a result of the legalization of marijuana in several states, because our friend Guzman and his partners made a corporate decision that to make up for their profits that they lost in marijuana, they realized that they had a ready-made audience, a ready-made market, rather, in America of people already addicted to opioids from pharmaceutical pills, either on prescription or sold out on the street. And they realized that they could undercut those prices. So they decided to do three things. Produce more opium, bought up thousands of acres in Sinaloa, Durango, and Guerrero, increase the potency, and lower the price. So what you're seeing now is a direct result of that. Because addicts in America who were paying $30 a dose for pharmaceuticals could get an equivalent high from $10 a dose from the Mexican new what's called cinnamon heroin. When the profits spiked for that and the Sinaloa cartel fell apart based on Guzman's recapture and some other things I won't go into, highly technical stuff, rival cartels then thought, aha, that's really working. We found this synthetic drug, fentanyl, that's 50 times the strength of heroin. So if we lace the heroin with that, we can compete with Sinaloa. So something called the New Jalisco Generation Cartels, no reason for y'all to know this really, started juicing heroin with fentanyl. Relatively easy to make. More deaths, because now people are shooting up amazingly strong stuff and dying, bam, on the spot. What to do about it? We will never make any progress on our drug problem on the supply side. It's impossible. Please don't talk to me about the wall. Please don't talk. Please don't. 75% of the illegal drugs that come into the country come in through gates. The wall will have gates. They're called San Diego, Laredo, and El Paso, and 19 other smaller ones. So you're looking at kilos of heroin in tractor trailer trucks that are 55 feet long that come through, for instance, El Paso, one every 15 seconds. Busiest commercial border crossing in the world. You'll never stop it on the supply side. It can only be stopped on the demand side. Now we get into the preaching part of our program today. Thank you for the... If anyone wants to be saved later, come on. It's a little bonus. We can only address it, you know, on the supply side. Opioids are always a response to pain. And thank God. Thank God for opioids. Because, you know, we have horrible physical pain that they relieve. But they also relieve other kinds of pain. Emotional pain, economic pain, psychological pain, social pain. And until we take a look at ourselves as a nation and take a look at the source of that pain, we're not going to solve this problem. So how do we address it immediately? We take the $88 billion, that's with a B, $88 billion we now spend trying to keep those drugs from coming through those gates, putting people into prison and keeping them there, $88 billion a year. And what I am going to suggest to you is that that money should be put into treatment, into rehabilitation. It should be put into schools. Because one thing we know is that when education rises, drug use falls. It should be put into startup businesses, factories, that people have jobs. Because when employment goes up, drug use drops. We know, yes, thank you, Matt. We know this. We know these things. We have the numbers. See, here we go. I'm going into the rant. I know I shouldn't do it. No, I did it in Bryant Park the other day in New York. People were fleeing. They were trampling their own children. Getting up. Fire trucks came in. People rented horses to ride out. We know. For every dollar we put into education in a prison for convicts, we get five back as a society in lowered recidivism rates. Why wouldn't you pay that money? Right? So that's my solution. But until we address the core problems, forget it. We're going to be in this endless cycle. I'm going to shut up. Thank you for the question.
Thanks for the answer. I wanted to ask two really quick follow-ups, not trying to
They're all going to throw things at you. You do it at your own risk, sir.
I got decent reactions.
Do you have metal things in the hat? Okay, go ahead.
The two follow-ups, sir. You talked about how the legalization of marijuana in first Washington and Colorado played into the change that has resulted in harms here.
Correct.
And you also, I think it was in the Post that you did like a full-page ad calling for the end of the war on drugs.
Yes.
So how do we do that incrementally, which a lot of folks would argue that recreational marijuana would be like would be incrementally towards that without getting the related harms. So that's the first. The second is, do you think Sam Quiñones gets it basically right in Dreamland when he talks about the Jalisco Boys and that narrative, or is there anything that really sticks out to you as problematic? And then the unrelated one is, can you ask your publisher to get the Neil Perry books back in print?
Okay.
They're impossible to find.
I'm going to answer two or three of those questions, okay? I would. Sam Quiñones is a great writer, great reporter. I'm not going to comment on his work, okay? Because I wouldn't like the it to be reciprocated. But I'm a fan. I don't know that we agree in every aspect. Two, the Neil Carey books will be coming back out, and you can find them. Just stay tuned. What else did you ask me?
How do you end the war on drugs?
End the war on drugs. You end it. How do you end any war? You stop it. We shouldn't do it in increments. See, the problem right now is what's known in criminology. Aren't you glad y'all came out today for this entertaining and lighthearted talk? In what we call the balloon effect, okay? You squeeze one part of the balloon, what happens? The air goes to another part of the balloon. So this is what happened with marijuana. I am for the legalization of marijuana, absolutely, but it had an unintended effect because we squeezed the marijuana part of the balloon and the air went into the heroin part of the balloon. This is why we need to do it across the boards for all kinds of reasons. That reason, but also it's in terms of social justice, in terms of race, frankly. Okay, so the way to end a war is stop fighting. Quit. We'd be better off if we lined the DEA up at the border and just had them buy the dope themselves. No, seriously, we would. It'd be a lot cheaper and a lot more effective. You know, just stop. I mean, you brought up marijuana. Look what happened. Three states. Marijuana imports dropped by 40%. Not my numbers, DEA numbers. The cartels won't even grow the crap anymore because they can't make any money at it. So if we legalized heroin, what would happen? The opium fields would dry up. It wouldn't be worth irrigating them. I'm sorry, I'm yelling and I apologize. But while I'm on my soapbox, I'm going to stop. Until the laws change, and the laws should change, I think it's unethical to do recreational drugs. I do. Because, you know, if you go out and do that coke, that was brought to you by people who murder and rape and kidnap women and children. You're just taking money out of your pocket and putting it into theirs. Now, I feel the same way about marijuana, and everybody has the same answer for me. Don't bother. Don't bother. I only smoke dope that was grown in my cousin Jim's garden box. I want to see cousin Jim's garden box because that stuff's coming in by the truckload. That must be some big garden, right? So I'm telling you, I'm here to ask you, unless you know the specific provenance of that drug, recreational drug you're doing, fine. If you don't and you do it, you're complicit in this violence and you're complicit in this problem. End of sermon. Yes, sir.
I'm going to digress a little bit.
Please.
I have more a question about your process. I know. Well, you probably hate these questions.
I love
anyway.
Talking about my
process. When you first started out with Cold Underground or Winter Frankie Machine, did you have any, self-doubt or just question yourself about the originality of the character, and how did you combat that?
I had nothing but self-doubt, sir. I think that's why it took me so long to start writing the books. You know, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea if I had any talent or not. I had no idea if that character was distinctive. You know, I have self-doubts usually like every Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday morning. Now, you know, I'm being fun, I'm being glib, so trying to lighten this up, but that's the truth. I think that when you do this full-time, you do this for a living, or even when you don't, you just do it, you carry that doubt around with you all the time. You know, I mean, when I finished this book and, you know, turned it in, I had no idea and still don't if it's any good or not. You know what I mean? It after a while, it just becomes noise. You can't even see the words on the page. But the issue about that is like a lot of things we have self-doubt about. You feel it and you move on. You know what I mean? You do it anyway. And I have respect for anyone who does it. You know what I mean? If anyone like conquers that self-doubt, even for an hour or a morning or 10 minutes, and sits down and puts words on a page or I guess on a screen anymore, to me, that person is a writer. You know? And should never let anyone tell them that he or she is not. You know, I respect it. But yeah, a lot of self-doubt. Yeah, then that first book's brutal. Oh, please, sir, if that's your concern, that is absolutely normal. You know, I won't give names, but I've been very lucky this week and been in conversations with two hugely best-selling authors, you know, much bigger than me, you know, and we talked about exactly that issue. You know, saying, man, there are some days when I just don't think I can do this gig. I mean, huge authors who go have that self-doubt. Absolutely.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. You're also very entertaining.
We try, ma'am.
I'm concerned about the after effects for people who are people of the force. What happens to these people afterwards? Do they suffer with PTSD? Mm-hmm. You can't just flush this stuff.
No, ma'am. Part of the research I did for this book was I consulted with a psychiatrist and a psychologist who treat PTSD. It's all they do. 90% of their clients are former military, police, and first responders. Mm-hmm. You know, cops have this very tough veneer that they develop, and it's a psychological defense mechanism, and it's a very necessary one. And they don't want to show us, and I get it, the hurt. But think it through. We see crime. You know, it's funny because everyone thinks that the primary relationship is between cop and criminal. It's not. Think through the logic. The primary relationship is between cop and victim. It's the cop who goes out there, who sees the body, who sees the wounded person, who goes to the emergency room, who goes to the morgue. It's the cop who rings the doorbell to tell a family your loved one is never coming home again. That's the cop. And for some of these cops, that's every day. Right?
Mm-hmm.
They see it, they feel it, they smell it. Not to get too graphic today, it's the smells that stay with them. And if you've ever been to one of those scenes, you know what I mean. So they will deny it as long as the day is long. But then you get into these, what I call the 2 a.m. conversations. We've all had them, you know. Things get quiet and things get serious and kind of intimate. And then they'll start talking about this case, this victim, that victim. Believe me, they feel it. Mm-hmm. And they take it with them. I think it's a good thing that police and a lot of men and women in these jobs, it seems now to be a little more acceptable to go get help for these things. But it's also interesting to me that the psychiatrist I consulted all had a private entrance room where people could go to see them without being seen. You know, so yeah, I worry about them too. And of course, you know, famously, the suicide rate among police officers is extremely high. Mm-hmm. It's also high among EMTs. Mm-hmm. By the way, the book is dedicated to 178 police officers who were murdered in the line of duty just in the time that I was writing this book.
What are your thoughts on Black Lives Matter?
I think Black Lives Matter have a point.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely have a point. You know, a lot of cops agree with me. And I think, you know, listen, we could talk about this for days, couldn't we? It's an extremely complicated issue. But I'm glad Black Lives Matter exists, glad that they're speaking out. But my problem is, I wish that we were all having more of a dialogue with each other about this. because if you ask me the question, are cops racist? I would say yes, absolutely, as racist as a society from which they come. And so when we look at this as a police problem, we're misunderstanding it. Are there police issues? Definitely. And I could talk about them and will if you'd like. You know, and I asked police officers about this. Tough conversations. But again, we need to back off it a little bit and look at it. It's an American problem. And I sometimes have to remind people, whether they invite me or not, that the era of mass incarceration for African Americans did not begin in 1993, began in 1619.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And police officers for most of our history as a country were not enforcing laws to protect African Americans, but enforcing laws to enslave African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So. Interesting. Yeah. Well, that's your next book. Well, the one you will do before you transition. We get that promise?
I didn't know I was transitioning.
No, I said before.
Do you know something I don't know?
No, it happened. It happens to all of us.
That's so I'm told, but you know, I could be the exception.
No, well, Reed being mortal.
Just because it happens to everybody else doesn't mean it's good. No, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
How are we doing for time, sir?
We've got time for a couple more.
Cool. Yes, sir. Hello again.
Hate to do two for, but so provocative. So in regards to, thank you for your sermon on drugs. So, is there a sermon about the Iron Pipeline that
yes.
plays the force? Is there a sermon about police brutality? Like,
There is. And if you all see the New York Times tomorrow, you'll see one.
Okay, cool.
It's out in the news. I can give it away. I've got an op-ed coming out tomorrow in the New York Sunday Times about some of these issues. A sermon about the Iron Pipeline. Do you know what the gentleman's referring to? The Iron Pipeline refers to Route 95 specifically, where guns come up from states that have loose gun laws, and then they find their way to cities like Washington, Chicago, and New York. So when Mr. Sessions, for instance, says things like, well, Chicago has some of the toughest gun laws in the country, but the worst violence in the country, what I would like to say, and in fact just did say to Mr. Sessions, is, well, you're very tough on the gangs that use these guns, but you don't care about the people who sell the guns, and you refuse to tighten up those laws and restrict the guns that kill teenagers and kill cops. Mm-hmm. So, again, what happens is that, they have these gun fairs and they have gun shops with very loose gun laws. Those guns end up on Route 95, the Iron Pipeline, and come into northeastern cities and fuel the violence. They also, of course, go the other direction down to Mexico and accomplish the violence there. Do I have lectures on police brutality? Sure, it looks, and we could talk about this all day, but I can't. There are so many different layers. Is there a racist layer? Absolutely. But it's more complicated than that. You know, let me try to simplify it very quickly. Some people shouldn't be cops. And cops will tell you that. I mean, when I call police and ask about these incidents, what the thoughtful ones will tell me is, in highly technical terms and much longer than this, some people shouldn't be cops, right? And in the smaller communities, they're not trained enough. You know, we give these people literally power over our lives and liberty. And in some cases, we hire them, we give them 2 or 3 weeks training, maybe they have some military background, and we say, here's your uniform, and go out there. Without the proper psychological screening, without the proper training, I said I wasn't going to do this, and I don't know how to answer your question without this. Do you know what I mean?
Gotcha.
But science tells us a lot about our unconscious or conscious biases. which become extremely dangerous in confrontations, particularly between minorities and white cops. Well, let's just be frank about it. So there are so many layers to this, sir, and it's frustrating. It's hard to address it, you know, here without, you know,
yeah,
warping.
You addressed it well in the forum, so thank you for that.
I try to. Thank you, sir. Last question. Let's have a moment of gratitude. Thank you. Yes, sir.
So I just came here. Sorry if this was already addressed, but what are your thoughts on programs in like Portugal where they have like medical heroin for addicts who are trying to come off of it?
I think I did kind of address it earlier, sir. Look, I mean, the case of Portugal is possibly instructive for us. They legalized drugs. What happened instantly was a fulfillment of chaos theory. Right? Drug use spiked. Mom and dad have gone for the weekend. We can have a party in the house. And then, shoom, dropped. So when drugs were illegal, Portugal had the worst drug problem in Europe. A year after drugs were legalized, Portugal has the lowest drug use in Europe. So I am all for any kind of program. I'm all for almost anything but what we're doing. What we're doing, we've been doing for 50 years. What's the result? Drugs are cheaper, more plentiful, more powerful, and more people are dying than ever. If that's winning, I'd hate to see what losing looks like.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.